Matthew Collings is an artist who's also written books about modern art, contemporary art, the London scene from Francis Bacon to Damien Hirst, the New York scene from Warhol to now. It's dismaying then to hear him say that when it comes to modern art, hardly anyone knows what they're talking about. And that's okay. So the title of one of his books, This Is Modern Art, it was also a Channel 4 series in Britain, is a bold one. The book itself is full of uncertainty and ambiguity. Maybe this is this and maybe that. You could look at it this way, maybe not. It's about young British artists, some of whom Collings likes. The Chapmans, for example, who you may know created a 3D version of Goya's masterpiece series, Disasters of War. But the Chapmans used miniature models acting out the atrocities. Goya in Airfix form. Matthew Collings likes that. I asked Matthew Collings then about the state of the art in Britain.
Well, you know, Brit art, it doesn't really exist anymore as it used to. It's a phenomenon of 10 years ago that had its heyday for about 5 years. And now those figures have sort of melded in with the international art scene. They're either winning trendies along with winning trendies from other parts of the world, or the loser trendies who no one remembers anymore. But the actual sort of movement, all this sensational stuff, that doesn't really exist quite in the same way that it used to.
Well, it couldn't, could it? I mean, you can't go on and on shocking because shock stops shocking.
Yeah, well, I think shocks actually still persist all throughout the international art world. But I suppose the fascination that existed on the part of the media and the general public who hadn't really heard of contemporary art before, their fascination with this group of artists, that maybe has died down a bit now. And that group of artists as a group has stopped existing. As I say, they've all divided up and separated into their little become individual stars, I suppose.
That's a shame, I suppose, because there was nothing the media liked more than to mock the Turner Prize winner.
Yeah, they still do a bit of mocking, but if anything, they're rather over-respectful towards the Turner Prize, in my view. The side of the media that looks at contemporary art in that aren't we shocked way is a sort of is rather ignorant about art, and it never really bothers to inform itself about art. So it still keeps trotting out the same old cliches. You know, is it art? And they're still scandalised, and they're still pretending to be shocked by nudity and money and stuff like that that they find in the art world.
There's a kind of interesting analysis that goes on in This Is Modern Art, your book, and the series as well, and you look at Goya. And Goya was really weird. I mean, really weird. Did some very, very strange paintings indeed. Shocking paintings. And you look at how he's filtered down through, well, for example, the Chapmans, and how they imitate him, how an awful lot of people do the Goya thing without the expertise somehow. Is that all right?
I'm not sure if... I think expertise is a difficult issue, a very important issue.
All right, without the originality, then.
Well, it's perhaps it's a different type of originality. I think the Chapmans are very talented at sort of wallowing in shocks in a sort of amusing, cynical way. And I think the thing about Goya is that he isn't fundamentally a cynic. He's very sort of disillusioned about humanity, and he looks at the dark side of humanity. And what you call weirdness is him coming up with images that express the sort of subterranean depths of the human psyche, which include a lot of horror, you know, these sort of murderous drives that apparently are in our unconscious. And he finds images for that. But I don't think in the end you could say that Goya was someone who delighted really in horror for its own sake, in the way that artists now are rather sort of smugly pleased with themselves that being able to parade all these shocks that the Chapmans are kind of good at doing. I think Goya is really a person of the Enlightenment, and he wants to fight cynicism, and he actually genuinely thinks that society can progress and get better. And I think he thinks that by his art, he's somehow shining a light on civilization. However dark and horrible those images might be, he's in the end on the side of the angels. He wants us to progress. And artists now, like the Chapmans, have a much more despairing, arrested, emotionally, I would say, retarded take on humanity. they're sort of having fun with blackness, with darkness, and saying, you know, look at this shock. You thought that was bad. Wait till you see this.
And yet you rate the Chapmans, or you used to.
Well, yes, you know, I used to, and I still do. I think all these things are relative perspectives, you know, in terms of a kind of black humour, satire-based art, which these people do. The Chapmans are at the top of the tree. They're sort of gods within that tiny little world.
That's very relative, isn't it?
It is relative, yeah. One's got to accept a bit of relativism. In an absolute sense, Goya is a gigantic figure of art, and he deserves his reputation in art history, and he certainly does tower above the Chapmans. But I think that's only to say that the moment of art that Goya is a star of is a much greater moment than the one we can possibly have now. Perhaps for many reasons, including the fact that, you know, it's movies and it's other kind of art forms which really deal with these big issues. I think art on the whole has become rather trivial.
Well, that's the depressing thing, because you've written a whole book, you've done a whole series, and that's the conclusion you reach, you know, that it's amusing, that it's cynical, that it's trivial and it's shallow. So why on earth do we care? What does it matter? Well, you say it doesn't really matter, does it?
Well, you know, we live in a society that's rather interested in shallowness. We're sort of obsessed by it.
Shallowness is the new deep, yeah.
I don't think anyone really cares about the deep anymore. I think, sadly, one's got to, if you step back and you take a look around, you see that we're getting shallower and shallower. We really are interested in surfaces. We're interested in sort of playfully inhabiting fictions. You very rarely find people who are willing to say, well, this is this and that isn't good enough and we should do this and this is how we should go ahead, unless they're politicians, in which case we know they're just speaking from a position of feathering their own nests and getting more power. You know, the shallowness goes with the cynicism.
You don't find it offensive that, you know, the Chapmans can imitate Goya and that Damien Hirst can recycle or transcribe Francis Bacon, which, as you've said, is a shortcut to significance, you know. Why would these people be allowed to become famous by taking shortcuts to significance, by recycling people who were presumably less shallow than they were, although that's debatable with Francis Bacon, I don't know.
Well, I think Francis Bacon, you know, in the sort of shallow stakes, it's a lot shallower than Picasso. I think Picasso is definitely in the league of Goya. You know, there really is a pecking order of great artists and lesser artists. And you don't get from period to period in art the same greatness. It's not that the greatness just moves ahead and takes a different form. You do have long periods where nothing much particularly is happening. And that we're going through a period like that now. You know, exciting things happen in movies and less so in art. The excitement in the art world at the moment about contemporary art is a sort of slightly artificial, hysterical excitement based on the fact that it's rather a trivial time. You say, why should those people be allowed to be famous, like the Chapmans and Damien Hirst? They are brilliant within the universe that they inhabit. They are at the top of the ladder. They are very good at what they do, which is to be funny, slightly silly and trivial, mock serious, genuinely satirical.
Or even serious mock. I mean, what about Richard Prince, whose entire oeuvre, as far as I can work out, is transcribing jokes that he's stolen from somebody else?
Well, that's not his entire oeuvre, but that is at the heart of his oeuvre. In the, you know, despair at humanity is at the heart of
not even very good jokes.
Well, not even jokes that he wrote himself. I think he got them from a joke book.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have, I think, you know, that book, This Is Modern Art, and the series, they're kind of introductions. They're amusing and often thoughtful and surprisingly, I would say, deep. It's a series of introductions, both the series and the book, into the problem of modern art, that it really does involve the problem of modern art and contemporary art. If you think modern art is the 20th century or late 19th century, beginning with Impressionism, running right through to Picasso and up to the 1960s when you got pop, minimalism and conceptualism. Then after that, you got kind of contemporary art and it all goes a bit daft. Now, the problem of modern and contemporary is that you have to educate yourself in that stuff. I would say you have to actually educate yourself in any kind of period of art. You know, there's so much that you can tell just by walking up to something and staring at it. And then you find out a bit more and then you can appreciate it a bit more. And the hoops that you have to jump through mentally to get all that contemporary art stuff I would say sometimes are maybe not even worth it. But if you are prepared to bother with it, then you can see why, you know, a joke might have some substance. And in that book, there's a whole chapter about jokes in art. It wasn't Richard Prince who invented the idea to have jokes. You know, maybe Marcel Duchamp invented it. And you've got Piero Manzoni making jokes. There's all sorts of people having a go. And the different ways. You've got the Dada movement, the Surrealists were jokesters.
Well, I mean, that's the point. You do point out, I think, that
it's a tradition. There's a tradition of it.
And contemporary art is no sillier, really, than the Situationist and the Surrealist, Duchamp or even Magritte.
It's a little bit sillier.
I'm trying to find some redeeming feature here.
Well, you know, I think those movements which are really part of modernism, Surrealism and Situationism, you could say that being original as they were makes them less silly than the Brit artists. I think the Brit artists are doing a sort of glamour thing which wasn't really available to the first set of isms. Those, when you really are avant-garde and you're on the edge of things and society really does reject you, that's slightly different than being a pampered pet of the London art world and living a sort of hotel, restaurant-infested lifestyle where you've got more money than anybody else and you act like a little spoilt brat.
Yeah.
So I don't deny the silliness of this gang of people, but I do say even within that, well, you know, just as Hollywood stars, some of them are very, very good actors and some of them are less so. In this arena of art, some of them come up with the relatively more brilliant and original ideas than some of the other artists. And Hirst is a bit of a bore at the moment, I would say, but 10 years ago, he was quite a bright spark. And, you know, perhaps his place has been taken now by the Chapmans, who keep coming up with fairly good ideas, I would say.
One of the interesting questions you ask is, it's as if we had a choice about which way to go. We could have gone this way or that way. Instead, we went for Warholian blankness instead of Picasso's joie de vivre, as you put it. Now, I don't know whether you think that's still the case, but if it is the case, why is it, or why was it? Why did we?
Well, I think it's a very complicated answer. I think the fact that one points to that choice having been made is already to go against the spirit of art at the moment. You know, the spirit of the art world at the moment is to clap and say how marvellous, you know, there's yet more biennales and art fairs. In fact, I'm coming to New Zealand to open an art fair. But there's yet more activity, there's yet more interfacing between the public and this weird little formerly elitist system of art. So we should all put on a party hat and say, great, you know, contemporary art is really rocking. But if you point out that, well, you know, it may be rocking, but what is it really? It's just a sort of party of kind of semi-nonsense with mystifying pseudo-meanings. And that art used to be more intense and more authentic, and its expressions used to be grounded in an object that really was quite marvellous. You would walk up to it and you would be amazed that anyone could make that. Whereas a lot of contemporary art, you've got these rather nondescript objects, which are surrounded by a buzz of talk, which performs a kind of voodoo magic on the nondescript object, making it seem special if you're in that club. Mm. And what is really happening with the public having a go now is that the public is being told obscurity is okay. In fact, there's rather something glamorous about it. You know, and you've just got to go around pretending that you find these trendy figures amazing instead of despising them, and then you'll go up a few notches on the social ladder. And the public is, so far, has proved itself willing to do that.
In a way, the point is the lack of authenticity, isn't it? Which feels like a cul-de-sac.
Yes.
I mean, there's only so many
times
you can say.
The point is very, very much the lack of authenticity. But I think to stop sort of hitting the artist for a moment, one could say that is, you find that a lot in society, that we live in an age of uncertainty and people don't really know what they feel about things. They don't really know if the whole idea of left and right in politics is quite as clear as it used to be. And you find people desperately willing to go along with this rather sort of empty consumerist existence because they're not really sure what other alternatives there are. You know, religion seems to be viciously fundamentalist, whether it's Muslims or Christians. You know, religion doesn't seem to offer any rich, thoughtful, spiritually meaningful approach to life. It's merely occupying this sort of a position of belief that seems almost like non-belief. You so desperately don't believe that there is goodness in the world that you're going to believe this set of primitively fundamental laws about the world being invented in 7 days, or, you know, whatever they think, who are not Christians.
Does it help us to imagine ourselves in 100 years' time looking back now and finding it fascinating?
No, we'll be even worse in 100 years. I think in 100 years they'll look back and they'll see all these tawdry objects that are paraded on the Turner Prize each year. And, you know, funnily enough, what they will say is, I see a very moving and accurate representation of how life really was in the 1990s or in the early 21st century. People really did live like that. These are the objects that express their values. Because they wouldn't necessarily be looking at those objects from an aesthetic point of view. They wouldn't necessarily be saying, this is an incredibly rich and aesthetically marvellous object, and I can't imagine how anyone was able to make that, but it really speaks to something deep inside me, which is how we look at Rembrandt and Goya and the Impressionists and Picasso, etc. So, you know, objects of art have different tales to tell depending on how you look at them. I don't think it's necessarily so that in 100 years people will look back on this stuff as absolutely without merit. They will still be able to read something from it.
So it'll be a commentary on our age, as it were.
Yes, and it may be that in 100 years we are far worse than we are now, that we're used to a much more grimly shallow existence than we're putting up with at the moment.
It's hard to imagine, really. I mean, I talked to Martin...
It is hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anything worse than what we've got now.
I talked to Martin Creed a while ago. Now, he's lovely. I really, really liked him. He doesn't call himself an artist, of course. He's got his light bulb going on and off. He's got his screwed up ball of paper. You know, now, I didn't want to like him, but I couldn't help liking him. At the same time, there's got to be some desperate joke going on there, somehow.
Well, I think the desperation of his jokes is pretty well staged. You know, he's a good editor of his own little performances. He does something that when we're looking for words to describe it, you know, really it's just a screwed up ball of paper. You know, he's kind of worked out how to make that work as a gag. So he...
So it's all a performance.
Well, in his case, yeah, I think what one could complain about, and I do actually increasingly complain about it more and more, is that surely art is not only about the brilliance of a black joie de vivre as opposed to Picasso's real joy in life that he expresses in his art. Surely art isn't, you know, surely satire is just too narrow a thing for art to be concerned with so exclusively. You know, how about having something a bit more humane and important that we can really be proud of achieving? And I think at the moment that isn't really on the agenda. You tend to get, as opposed to sort of very, very amusing silliness, you get rather empty solemnity instead of profound seriousness, I would say.
Do you think what's happened is that, you know, we've all these well-meaning lovies and educators and who knows who have rabbited on about how art needs to be embraced by the general society. And what that's done is simply popularised it and turned it into another commercial good, a commodity.
Well, you know, it's not wrong for art to be popular, and it's not wrong for more and more people to be interested in art. I don't think anyone.
No, but what does
that
do to the art? What does it do
to the art?
Well,
you know, one doesn't want art to be elitist, but one does want it to be magnificent and excellent.
Maybe that's the same thing, though.
No, you've got to up the level of people's expectations and up the level of people's knowledge about art, not down the level of art so that more people can be involved in it.
Oh, Lord. I mean, that's like saying, isn't television fabulous because now we can watch all those really interesting documentaries? When in fact people just want to watch, you know...
Television
Big
often
Brother.
Is fabulous.
Big Brother is what people
Big
want
Brother
to watch.
Is pretty fabulous. I like Big Brother. But I don't say that it's Rembrandt. I mean, I know the difference. You know, also Big Brother isn't The Sopranos. I don't know if you get that over there.
Yeah, we do.
But yeah, you know, there are levels of TV. You can tell something's more excellent, more work's gone into it. There's more intelligence, there's more thoughtfulness going on. There's more gripping drama going on in it. But the parallel with art is that we are being told that everything we've got at the moment is Rembrandt, or everything we've got at the moment is Van Gogh, that it's in the tradition of an ancient history of art that goes back to the Greeks. But I would say that simply isn't true. You know, it's in the tradition of Warhol, who's a good figure, you know, exciting figure in modern art. But he's not the only thing that art can do. We don't really have anything now that's in the tradition of Picasso, or that's in the tradition of Jackson Pollock, or that's really in the tradition of Manet or Courbet or the Impressionists. That tradition has dried up. It probably dried up in the 1950s. We have merely riffs on jokey irony, despairing celebration of futility.
Everything's had to destroy whatever went before, though, hasn't it? I mean, I think you've said Picasso had to kill tradition and Pollock had to kill Picasso and Warhol.
They kill it in a certain way. They, you know, Picasso and Pollock and even Warhol to some extent are looking over their shoulders at the history of art.
Right.
I mean, what you've got now is people replicating in a gagster way, gagster as opposed to gangster, way, the history of art. So the Chapmans might replicate Goya, but they're not really influenced by Goya. In fact, they're not really even interested in Goya. What they're interested in is society's awe at a famous artist called Goya, who really represents a lot of shallow values that society has at the moment, which are to do with celebrity and money and success. People think that, oh, Goya, you know, his paintings are worth millions of pounds, and, oh, look, they're a bit scandalous as well. And, you know, that's the cleverness of the Chapmans. They're really looking at, they're not really looking at Goya, they're not really looking at the tradition of art, they're looking at what society's desires are at the moment.
Tell me about another artist that you rate, Sarah Lucas. Describe to me her work.
Well, her work has gone through various forms. I like it when it's a made object that has a sort of rough surface and she puts things together in a surprising way. But on the whole, her work...
For example?
She did this... let's get it right now, because she's done a few different things.
Let's talk about... You remember the sculpture, Bitch?
Yeah, what's bit? Yeah.
Packet of kippers. Packet
that's
of kippers.
The one, yeah.
Packet
You've
of
got
kippers.
A table with a packet of kippers at the back and two melons at the front. In
a string bag.
Yeah, in a string bag. So it's like a joke, iconic woman. And all her works are more or less sex symbols or refer to sex. And she makes an object that expresses in a sort of physical sculptural way some kind of sexist attitude. I wouldn't say it's particularly feminist, the work, actually. You know, it's not like complaining about sexism. It's being savagely ironic about sexism, you know. And I think what characterises her work is a rather sort of vicious attitude, which can be compelling when she comes up with objects that have a bit of sculptural value. Now, when you say, bloody hell, you know, a table with a couple of melons and a packet of kippers, A, that sounds daft and anyone can do it, and B, it's kind of offensive and disgusting. And, you know, there's all sorts of angles from which you could complain about that work. But when you see it in a gallery, it's got some sculptural qualities. Now you've got to think that we were talking about Picasso. Picasso makes very, very impressive, indeed sometimes awesome sculptural objects out of bits of old rubbish. You know, makes a baboon out of a toy car. And a bit of makes a bull's head out of a bicycle seat. So there's... It's not that there isn't a tradition of great art where a creative artist puts together bits of tacky nonsense and can make something impressive out of it. To some extent, Sarah Lucas is in that tradition. But of course, to some extent also, like the Chapmans, she's ironising that tradition and mocking it for the sake of making a point about contemporary society. So, you know, it's not insignificant that she is a woman making sexist objects or objects which have elements of sex about them.
Does it ever worry you that because everything is so full of irony and amusing...
Well, I personally hate all this bloody irony
stuff. Well, and then...
I know about it and I feel I'm familiar with it. You know, I know that art, I've grown up with it. I feel I can explain it. It's not, I must say, my interest.
No. But what I mean is that because everything is so full of it, that sort of detached... careless irony, nothing
that's a
matters.
Problem,
irony.
Yeah.
When Sarah Lucas comes along and seems as if she actually bloody cares about something, no matter what it is, it touches something in us and we respond to it. So that's in some way, I don't want to use the expression dumbing down, but what the hell dumbing down?
I would say it's a problem that it's possible to see all these artists are the same as all merely being ironic. On the one hand, I'm fed up with irony, let's have some sincerity. You know, what are you going to be sincere about? Well, that's a difficult question. You know, you have to look at the history of art. Maybe you have to be a bit more formal and a bit more abstract and think about shapes and colours and how they interact and how they can be very moving in a painting, you know, and try and make that work or in a sculpture or in some kind of object. on the other hand, if you are going down the irony route, if you are sort of making a kind of art that expresses the zeitgeist of the moment, not just in the art world, but I would say in the whole of society, then you can make those objects with a bit of intensity. And I think that's what Sarah Lucas sometimes does. So that, you know, she's produced a lot of work, she's uneven, but when it's really working and there's a bit of electricity there, then it's because she has come up with an object that has some surprise impact to it, and that surprise is in its visual qualities. She's collaged together some bits and pieces, and they come up with something that has a bit of visual impact. And she did that with that work bit. She did it with another work, which sounds equally daft when you describe it. It's a table. The work's called Two Fried Eggs and a Kebab, and it consists exactly of those elements on a table. If you did it yourself, it probably wouldn't be much good, but, you know, it's somebody with an eye doing it. They've got an eye, and they're used to materials, they're used to putting things together. They can make something happen. That is the magic that Picasso can do, and to some extent, that's the magic that Sarah Lucas can sometimes do.
It sounds insanely old-fashioned to ask you if beauty matters anymore at all.
Well, beauty is a bit of a word, you know, it's part of a sort of litany of a beauty, greatness, genius, or angels coming out and violins playing. So I think in that sense it doesn't matter, and it's a sort of lie. But if you wanted it to matter, which I do, then you have to examine it and see what it is. You know, what is it in art? You know, it's the something being visually compelling and impressive and having some substance and looking as though the artist put some hours in. You know, and that the artist is speaking from some visual experience. You know, the word experiences could even contain beauty. Somebody is able to put some marks together on a canvas which are moving, and you could say, well, that's beauty. I think that's what the Impressionists do. They're not really painting anything special. They're painting some boring bourgeois people out having a picnic. But they put a few dabs of blue together in a way that is lasting and affects you and is rather moving. And when you're feeling a bit solemn about life and you're not sort of skipping along to the death march of consumerism, and you feel like popping into the National Gallery one afternoon and being a bit quiet and thoughtful, as I sometimes do, I'm very, very happy that Renoir existed and that he painted some bloke rowing in a boat on the suburb of the Seine. And what makes me happy, I would say, is beauty. It's a beautiful surface that he's made, about 18 inches wide, a little painting, some blue, some yellow, some dabs here and there. He's conjured up some beauty, and that's all really that Leonardo is doing, or that Michelangelo is doing in marble, or that the Greeks did in the 5th century BC when they thought of, you know, instead of having monster gods carved out of stone, let's have objects that look very much like humans. You got the first really realistic figurative art. It's not really just that they're figurative, it's because they're beautiful. You know, those guys had an eye. They put something together that's worth looking at. But you've got to keep remaking it for your time. You've got to
find out. Is anybody remaking it now?
Well,
or is it something that we'll only recognise when things have got worse?
I think it is probably there, even in the art that we've been talking rather lightheartedly about. That, you know, maybe there's some design elements in the way the Chapmans arrange their shocking stuff. And the way Sarah Lucas puts her bits and pieces together, maybe it's there to a lesser degree, but even in some sense, in some of the things that Martin Creed has done with his lights going off and his screwed up balls of paper, I don't think those artists are entirely unvisual. The emphasis is on ideas, and certainly the emphasis of explanation tends to be on ideas with them. But one is better than another. One of the, you know, those artists are at the top of the pecking order because of a certain flair they have for the visual. Maybe it's that we simply, our culture now simply doesn't value talking about that so much.
Well, the other thing, I mean, at the most basic level of argument about our culture is that it is so easy to give ourselves beauty. I mean, we've got computers and televisions and fashion, and everywhere you look there is something that demands to be seen as beautiful, which has surely devalued. I mean, when, you know, Tintoretto was doing his thing, then maybe beauty was less accessible to people who valued him.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. And certainly you could say that was true of a slightly earlier era when, you know, medieval person's only real experience of very strong colour would have been religious art. Mm. You know, they lived a sort of life of gruelling toil most of the time. you get a certain kind of designer elegance that is very easy to achieve now through computers. I think that's what you're talking about.
Well, it's everything.
We live surrounded by a lot of designed objects, many of which are kind of hideous and bland, actually, I would say. And then every now and again, there's an explosion of loveliness. You know, London's going through this kind of architectural renaissance over the last 10 years. When you walk by the Thames now, it is staggeringly beautiful. Mm. You know, the new buildings that are coming up, the new bridges, the sight of it all. When in the 70s, it was all sort of grim and it was like a T.S. Eliot poem and you wanted to commit suicide when you were by the Thames. And now you go by there and you feel like doing a little dance. You know, it's so nice. You could say that was a kind of superficial, easy beauty, you know, but I don't know. I suppose your question suggests that art is always about a much heavier, more profound and essential beauty, I suppose, that it's beauty tied to some more profound meaning. And actually, I would agree with you that is the job that we have traditionally given to art. And it would be a great shame if it turns out we don't really want anyone to do that job anymore.
Maybe we don't need anyone to do that job anymore because it's been done. You know, Matisse gave us this and Renoir gave us that.
Oh, no, that's never the case, because when all Matisse is doing is keeping the ball rolling that Tintoretto is part of and the Greeks are part of, you know. No, you, by that token, you'd say, well, the Greeks did some good sculptures, we don't need Tintoretto. You know, people remake things according to the values of their age. We're hardwired to be fascinated by and to be moved by beauty, by symmetry, by arrangement, by things looking good. But it may be that at the moment we're sort of willing to allow the movies to find it for us. And we don't see really why it should be art. You know, artists sort of been moved to the margins of society because of all the technological
Well, certainly painting. I mean, painting isn't...
Yes,
where
what is painting is just this sort of archaic thing that people carry on doing, but there's no real social need for it. Mm. And that might be something that we all need to struggle with at the moment.
I mean, even people who do still paint, I don't know whether Chris Ophelia is still using elephant dung.
Now, yeah, but he doesn't only use elephant dung.
No.
It is beautiful, yeah, because it isn't just a lump of dung.
No.
You know, it's a lot of different materials all arranged, including a lump of dung.
But in 100 years' time, will we look at his stuff and think, gosh, that's really beautiful? Or will we look at his stuff and think, oh, that's the guy that used elephant dung?
If we're aesthetically trained, and if we've sort of thought about things, and if we've looked at a bit of art and we're familiar with art, we would look back and say some of those Chris Ophelia paintings are very, very beautiful and he deserves his reputation. But if the whole sort of culture of thinking about art and training your eye and looking at art and trying to find out what art is about has died in 100 years, then we'll say that's the guy who used to do elephant dung.
you admire critics like Clement Greenberg, who was writing
more
in the 30s.
Yeah, more than anybody. Yeah. John Ruskin in the 19th century and Clement Greenberg in the 20th century.
Is it?
Two
do we?
Big heroes.
I suppose you might be the Clement Greenberg for now, but it's hard.
No, I don't have that depth of education, and I'm from a different age.
A different art. I mean, he developed this meta theory and added to the art, so we can read him and look at the stuff he's talking about, and it, you know, expands in our brain. But there's not enough now to give us a meta theory that's meaningful, is there? I mean, this is why...
Actually, I think you've hit on a very good point. You know, he lived in a profoundly serious age, and he was a very serious man. Now, he was attacking hastiness and trivia and shallowness, but... he did not yet quite live in a world where those things absolutely dominated existence. Mm. He saw that world coming, and for a time he thought the problem was capitalism and that, you know, he was going to be a good old Marxist and stop all that. And then after a while he gave that up and he realised that it wasn't a political problem. It was a more profound problem that politics couldn't really solve. And that actually, if anything, he became more right-wing as he got older. Or I would say he became apolitical, actually. He sort of stopped bothering with politics. And he stopped tying his aesthetic ideas to politics, that's the thing. But when he started out, he really did come up with a lot of incredibly impressive theories about history and society and meaning and art and politics, which really tied up the whole thing. Certainly no one is doing that now. And I'm afraid I don't have the capacity to do it myself. I'm not.
But maybe you haven't got the material to do it yourself. I mean, maybe.
Well, you make the material yourself. He made the material himself. He was working in a Philistine culture, you know, and there wasn't really much going on in New York at the time. He sort of made that culture himself. And then people followed and they started scratching their heads and stroking their chins and saying, oh, yeah, art, you know, let's take that seriously. But that was something that people in Europe had done. You know, people in America hadn't really, there were a few isolated artists over in America, but there wasn't really a very heavy culture of art until he came along and it started forming around him.
Do you like Robert Hughes?
Yes, I do. I respect him very much.
Because, I mean, he takes a very firm line on people like Julian Schnabel and...
Yeah, I don't agree with the things that Robert Hughes says in terms of individual artists. I think he very much mistakenly underrates Schnabel and Basquiat, those artists of the 80s, who I think are genuinely talented as painters. But
I think what he despises about them really is their sheer kind of ego-ridden celebrity status, which...
Yes, I don't think they are sheer ego. I think they are celebs, or at least one of them's dead. They both were celebrities and they both had a lot of ego, but they're not only that. I mean, I think Robert Hughes is perfectly capable of seeing the talent in the work, but he refuses to see it.
Mm.
Because he's got an overriding agenda, and I've got to respect that, you know, he wants to say that some other artists who he thinks are sincere and less egotistical are good. And so for that reason, he's going to knock these guys. So he thinks that Frank Auerbach and Paul Arago and Lucian Freud are very talented, and Sean Scully are very talented and important artists. And therefore, Jean-Michel Basquiat and Schnabel are not. And I don't think that quite works out.
Mm. It's sometimes you just want all that other stuff to be cut away, don't you? And you want to be put in a room and not know who's done what. But it's surrounded by the hype and the buzz and
yeah,
the passing.
Yeah, well, you're
and the
right. I think you have to do that work yourself. You know, it's not wrong to be aware that artists live a very worldly existence now. And it's not wrong to be aware that they make a lot of money. You know, they are not gods. They are not Mozart. They're not Plato. They're not precious people. You know, it's quite right to notice that they are part of the same corruption that everybody else is part of. And they're part of this drift of society towards a shallow, greedy, selfish, ego-gratifying existence.
But don't you find that offensive, though? Damn it. I mean, one of the prerequisites for being an artist, I always thought, was to have a kind of outsider's truth.
Well, I think the only reason for art to exist is for it to have something to say other than what the society...
demands of it.
Other than society's base aims.
Quite right.
That the reason to have art is that it expresses some kind of higher realm.
Yeah.
And so when you see artists behaving like that, well, it's right to complain. But you're also right in what you said earlier, that sometimes you have to sort of forget about that and just look, well, what is the object doing? And I think that's where Robert Hughes sometimes is blinkered. You know, he refuses to consider the aesthetic merits of Schnabel and Basquiat, because he simply won't allow himself to believe that they are there, because those guys are too successful in his view.
Yeah.
He wants to smack them for being so successful.
Yes. You're an artist, or...
I am.
I don't know whether you're still arting.
I am, very much so. I'm an abstract artist. I paint abstract paintings, which are about balancing a few colours together in a way that I hope has something to do with what I was saying earlier about the loveliness of Renoir and the Impressionists, you know, about colour just kind of working on its own without any other meanings to be moving and beautiful. But there is something odd about my painting, and that is that I don't do them entirely on my own. I do them as a sort of 50-50 collaboration with my wife, who's also an artist.
She's a mosaicist?
She's a mosaicist. She makes mosaics, yeah.
And does she do that with your work on the same...
No, but she applies the sensibility that she's developed over the decades of doing mosaic, which has to do with putting one colour next to another colour. She applies that sensibility to these paintings. Now, the way it works out, actually, if you're interested, is that she actually thinks up the paintings and works out the colour relationships, and I execute them. I paint them. So, you know, The paint has a sort of touch to it, you know, a bit of life to it, because I've put it on the canvas in a certain way. But it's really Emma, which is my wife, who thinks up the colours which should go next to which.
And why do you do it?
Oh, it's very important to me. It always has been. And I didn't go to critics school or TV presenter school. I went to art school in the 70s when I was young, and I always thought I would be an artist. I've always kind of thought that I was one. The better question is, why do I do this other stuff? I do this other stuff as a job, but I do art because I was good at it and I thought I should do it and I felt I had something to say, you know, and it means something to me, and I feel it connects to something important in history. It connects to the tradition of art, which I value very much and I'm rather awed by.
That sounds strangely old-fashioned.
Oh, yeah, I am pretty old-fashioned, yeah.
So you must...
But, you know, you can be old-fashioned and still have an awareness and an interest in what's going on around you, which I do have. I'm interested in contemporary life, I'm interested in society, I'm interested in how people carry on, their behaviour, the way fashion works, the way language works. And I'm sort of have this curse of always wanting to gabble away commenting on things, and I've made a living out of doing that. And so what I try and do is I try and focus that comment on the area of art.